So I'm Otterbury, and I'm from Cambridge. I live in Cambridge, which is a very different place to Manchester. Every time I come to Manchester, I'm kind of reminded of that. How big Manchester is becoming, how populous Manchester is, how kind of gritty Manchester is. Cambridge is a very kind of genteel place. Manchester is much more in your face. There are positive sides to that and challenging sides to that. And one of the things that strikes me about coming here is the number of homeless people. Every time I come, it seems to the number of people sleeping out on the pavement, begging out on the pavement, seems to get bigger and bigger. And it was quite a cold day, wasn't it, today? It was quite a clear day, but quite a cold day. And I was quite kind of cold going out, and there were people who were sitting on the pavement for hours, sometimes sleeping on the pavement. And it seems quite kind of shocking, actually. So Manchester, you've got these... Well, I imagine very expensive loft apartments. You've got a lot of money in Manchester, and you've got a lot of poverty too. And we do, I mean, there are people who beg in Cambridge, but it's quite a shock to see so many people out on the street, sleeping out on the street in Manchester. Good to be back in Manchester, good to be back at the MBC, staying in the men's community, the new community above the centre. I hadn't been to the community, I hadn't stayed in the community for about 18 years, I think. I was very involved with the refurbishment of the Manchester centre. We got the warehouse, and then we had to create this Buddhist centre. And you'll have heard me talk about this if you've been to previous talks. So being in the community again, now it is a community again, now it is a Buddhist community again, it's lovely. It really lifted my heart, actually, spending the last 2 days there. It was very much part of the vision of the creation of the Buddhist centre. And it's 20 years, isn't it, since the centre opened, 1996. For me, it's very, very vivid. It was a hard time, it was a challenging time, leading up to the opening of the centre. Just before the opening of the centre, the IRA let their bomb in Manchester. I don't know whether any of you were living in Manchester at that time, but you'll kind of remember that. That changed the city. 20 years ago today, and... I was mentioning this to Saul, and Saul wasn't even born 20 years ago. It seems kind of incredible. And 20 years ago, it makes me reflect on the centre. We opened the centre. We put a lot of hard work into the Buddhist centre. Blood went into the mortar here. That isn't just a metaphor. I mean, literally, blood went into the plaster here. And why did we do it? I asked myself that question quite a lot in those days. 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd wake up and I'd think, why are we doing this? Why have we moved from Chorlton? It got me thinking again, why are we doing this? What is the purpose of having a Buddhist centre? Is the purpose of having a Buddhist centre to teach meditation? Is that what we're about? Are we a kind of adult education centre? Or are we an information centre? Are we passing on to the good people of Manchester some of the mysteries of the East? Are we introducing the people of Manchester to the Buddha, to the teachings of Buddhism? Are we teaching mindfulness? Is that our purpose here? So what is our purpose? And are we meeting that purpose? So I'm just going to leave that hanging in the air for a moment, for a few moments. I'm leaving that hanging in the air. And I'm going to talk about something completely different. And I will come back to that question. What are we doing here? What is our purpose here? I want to talk about something I watched on BBC iPlayer a few weeks ago. And I'd seen, you know, the little box. Sometimes you, at the programmes, you've got a little box and a little picture, haven't you? And it was called The Age of Loneliness. And there was an old person in the little box. And I thought, oh, well, that must be a documentary about loneliness in old age. And I didn't look at it. I didn't kind of open the programme until sometime later. And I watched the documentary, and the documentary wasn't just about loneliness in old age. It was it covered all ages, all backgrounds, all types of life in a way. The youngest person in the documentary, I think, was 18, and the oldest was 100, a 100-year-old kind of lady. And you can still watch this. I watched some of it last night. It's still on the site. And I recommend it, actually. It's a very, very moving documentary. One of the most moving things about it is that these people are willing to speak about their loneliness, which is a bit of a taboo subject, isn't it? Willing to speak about their loneliness on camera. You know, it's going to be kind of broadcast. They're willing to admit that they are lonely. And I've experienced loneliness in my life, really painful loneliness at some points in my life. And it is difficult to speak about. It is difficult to admit when you feel lonely. So I want to talk about some of what some of the people in that documentary, some of the kind of moving people. They were not sad or kind of pathetic people. They were people like us. They were people like me, people like you. And the first person in the documentary was this 18-year-old young woman. She'd left home. She'd left her good friends. She'd left home for the adventure of university. Her friends were really excited, you know, that she was going to do this. She was going to start this new era in her life. So she went off to university full of kind of hope. She was going to make new friends. And it wasn't like that. She found it really, really difficult to make friends. And she kept in touch. She said she kept in touch with her friends through Facebook and other social media. And on Facebook, you don't put that you are lonely. You don't put that you haven't been out for 2 days. You put the kind of the high points in your life, don't you? I believe I'm not a member of Facebook, but I imagine it's like this. You put the things that you've been doing, which are fun, and so she in a way put things on Facebook. She wasn't telling the kind of true story of that, and it was difficult to kind of watch in a way her talking about her isolation and her loneliness and how her bedroom was both a refuge and a prison. So for 2 or 3 days sometimes she didn't leave her bedroom. This young woman, and very courageous of her to talk about that. Several of the people interviewed were elderly. They'd been married, they'd lost their partner, maybe their partner of many years, 50, 60 years sometimes. One old lady was talking about how her partner was everything to her. Everything. And when he was ill, when she was looking after him, she never believed that he would actually leave her. And there was a sort of bitterness, there was even an anger that he'd gone, he'd left her. Both love and kind of anger, frustration. And they'd had no friends. They'd had each other. And this happened to several of the people being interviewed. They were everything to one another. And when one of them went, there was nobody. It was a kind of searing loneliness. Every day, waking up, keeping yourself busy, keeping yourself active, and for the long day ahead. It was really moving to and as I say, really moving to hear them talk about that. So bereavement was a great cause of loneliness. And divorce and separation was another great cause of loneliness. And with divorce, your friends, you had a group of friends, were your friends. As a couple, they were friends of you both. Sometimes with separation and with divorce, your friendship circle disappeared. I don't know whether your friends felt, you know, they didn't know who to be friends with. But your friendship circle very often disappeared. They were interviewing one man who'd got two teenage sons, and he loved his sons. But he longed for grown-up conversation. He longed for someone to share his hopes with, his fears with, his thoughts with, his life with. There were people who were lonely because they wanted love. They wanted a partnership. They felt that if they only had a partner, if they only found someone on these dating sites, if they found someone, that would be the end of their loneliness. And there was quite a contrast between that, because you also had people on who had found someone and had lost them through divorce or through death. There was one man in his 40s who got up 4 in the afternoon. He got up, and for him, what helped him survive were computer games. They filled a kind of gaping hole of his life. And he was asked by the person interviewing, how do you feel about being interviewed? How do you feel about the camera crew being here? And he said it was wonderful. In a way, it was great having company. So although he was kind of being broadcast in a way to the nation, for the time the camera crew were there, he had company. And he said it would make so much difference if I had someone just for an hour, once or twice a week, just to talk to. That would mean that my life, I would have something to live for in the week. So today in the UK, more people than ever before in our history live alone. 7 million people live alone. We live in our big cities, don't we, our growing cities. We live on top of one another in our cities, and there is an epidemic, they say, of loneliness. Loneliness and depression. Those two things feeding one another. Depression leads to isolation. Loneliness leads to depression. And it gave me a lot of food for thought, the programme. As I say, it was deeply, deeply touching. People allowing you into this painful, painful experience of their lives. And it reminded me of an experience in my own life. When I, for a long time, when I was a child, I wanted to be a priest. I wanted to be a Catholic priest. From the age of 7, I was brought up in an Irish Catholic family. I wanted to lead a spiritual life from the age of 7. And badgering my parents, they eventually let me go to a seminary when I was 15 to train for the priesthood. And within a few months, I lost my faith. It all kind of unraveled. It was such a painful time in my life. My whole trajectory in life, my whole purpose of life sort of disappeared. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. So I came home. My parents, while I was at the seminary, had separated. And I was looking after my two sisters. My mother left my sisters with my father. It's a long story. I won't go into here, but a long and painful story. And my father I went into a college of further education to do my O-levels. And what year would have this been? The 70s. So it was long hair and Afghan coats. Yeah? So imagine that. You've probably seen it on television if you weren't there. And I went to this college and I'd got short back and sides. So I was at a seminary. I was so square. And I started midterm. And so I was introduced to this class of students who had all connected, who'd all bonded. And I was alone. And when we went for coffee, I sat on my own. When I went for lunch, I had lunch on my own. Oh, it was a really painful time for me. And it was a little bit in the canteen, in the refectory, as if there was this big sign saying, he's on his own, you know. And sometimes people would approach me, but I didn't want pity either. I didn't want sympathy, but I longed for connection. I also, I suppose, pushed people away. It was a very, very painful time. So what I did, a strategy for coping with this, I stopped going in. So every day I would say to my father, I'm going into college. I'd get the bus in and with my sandwiches, and I wouldn't go to college. I'd hang around the town all day, the library all day, trying to avoid anybody from the college. And then I'd get the bus home, in the evening. My dad would say, how was college? And I would say, it was fine, yeah, it was fine. And it went on like this, day after day, week after week. The weekends were fine. They were kind of normal times, and then the week would start again. And I loved my dad, and together we were kind of raising my sisters, and I felt it really, really important to be honest with him. But I couldn't be honest. I couldn't admit how isolated and lonely I felt at college. And the more I didn't go in, the more I didn't tell him what was going on with me, the lonelier and more isolated I felt. And there was a time during that where I considered actually ending my life. Now when I think about it, the tragedy that would have been, you know. And I thought if I hang on to the next term, things might be different. And so this was, you know, this was a few months away. There was a dangerous time because my dad was giving me my money for my bus fare. My contract, my student kind of contract hadn't come through. Anyway, he said, why hasn't your contract come through? So he rang the college and he left a message. And then he got a letter one day saying the reason why I hadn't got a contract was I hadn't been in college for several weeks. So when I came home from college, I was presented with this. And I said, there must be some mix-up. You've seen me going into college every day. And I can't tell you how awful a period that was for me. I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I felt more and more kind of isolated, more and more lonely, more paranoia, you know, almost. Anyway, the new year started, a new influx of students, and I joined again as a new student. I joined and started again, and I made friends. Whew, I made friends, but I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that period of my life. How depressing, how lonely that was. And I was, how old was I at this point? I was 16, and I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I finished talking about the program, but just by mentioning one more person from the documentary. So this is a young woman who's from New Zealand, very, very confident, a real kind of go-getter, who knows in a way what she wants. She'd come over from New Zealand with her husband to London, and very successful. And they decided to separate. He'd gone back to New Zealand. She wanted to stay. And she was putting more and more time into work. And the reason why she was doing that is she didn't want to go home. She didn't want to go home because at home there was nobody. And this very, very confident, attractive, likable woman, the mask slipped for a moment, and it was there how lonely she was, how isolated and lonely. And she had got kind of initiative, and she was involving herself in a charity that looked after elderly old people. And she, you know, they met once a Sunday, twice a Sunday, every month she would go along. And she said to the camera, she said to the interviewer, in a way, she didn't know who was getting most out of this. Whether she was getting most out of it or whether the older people were getting out of it. And it was very, very, touching. And after the programme, what I do in the mornings is very often I go for a walk by the River Cam, and I pass people on their own, young people, old people, men, women, and I've begun to look at them in a different way. I've begun to wonder what their history is. Are they just out for a walk like me, or are they bereaved, or are they divorced, are they lonely? It got me really thinking. For the young, the loneliness may just be circumstantial. When circumstances change, they may make friends. Like the young woman at university who eventually did make friends. But they too, like the middle-aged, they too, like the elderly, may not. They may be caught in a cycle of increasing loneliness. We're social creatures, aren't we, as human beings? We thrive with companionship. We thrive in friendship. And we can thrive also sometimes living a solitary life, but a solitary life of choice. When aloneness is not a choice, when it's something that is imposed or seemingly imposed upon us, it can be really searing. And I remember having found Buddhism. I first encountered Buddhism in 1984. I wanted meaning in my life. I wanted a spiritual meaning in my life. I wasn't quite sure what I meant by that, but I wanted something that was bigger than me in my life. What I didn't expect, I think, was friendship. I didn't expect that friendship was one of the highest values of Buddhism, that I would meet some of the who have become some of my closest and deepest friends. And this takes me back, in a way, to my question at the beginning. What is the Buddhist Centre about? Is it to inform people about Buddhism? Is it to teach them a meditation technique? To introduce them to mindfulness? What is our purpose? What is the what is it we're trying to do at the Buddhist Centre? And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to create spiritual community. That's why we teach Buddhism. That's why we teach meditation. We're trying to create a truly human context. We're trying to develop spiritual community. I think to be truly human, you need meaning in your life, and you need a meaning that is bigger than you. Being able to respond to a truth that is bigger than your truth. This can get abstract when really it's quite concrete. To find ourselves We need to find others. We need to positively move towards others. We need to kind of self-forget. And in that self-forgetting, we awaken to the reality of others. That there are others. The key, I think, is selflessness. Being unselfish, being interested in others. So when we teach meditation here at the centre, when we lead a meditation course here at the centre, I think what is really important is that people are introduced to the possibility of something wider, something deeper. They're introduced to the possibility of living a kind of new life, not just going away with a meditation technique, not just going away with some information about Buddhism. And I think that is possible to do. I think it's possible to come on a meditation course and think at the end of the 6 weeks, you've got it. You just go away and you do it. We live not just in an age of increasing kind of isolation and loneliness, but we live in an age of growing kind of individualism, where society is much less cohesive. People are much less connected. That isn't that machine, is it? So I imagine, I hope that this is what we're doing in our Buddhist centres, our Tree Ratna Buddhist centres. We are offering that. We are offering kind of a human community. We are offering spiritual community. We're offering something. You take a step into the Buddhist centre, you don't know where that might lead. The people that you are there at the beginner's course with, the drop-in course, the regulars course, these may be the important people that in a way make the difference in your life, are there for you, and you're there for them in difficult times. During Christmas, I was away staying with friends, and there was a lot of stuff on the news about flooding, even flooding in Manchester. I imagine kind of, you know, the river Irwell rising up. It wasn't quite as dramatic as that, was it? But in certain places in the north of England, I think they'd been flooded for the third time. And on the news, this woman was saying they're tired, they're exhausted. But one of the positive things about that, one of the positive things about a crisis situation is that people sometimes who've not talked to one another, people who are neighbours but not interacted, a crisis situation pushes you beyond your difference, your isolation. You help one another. You come together to help one another. A crisis situation, something like that, a natural disaster, offers that possibility. I remember there was some of that going on when the bomb went off here in Manchester. But then the crisis is over and it's quite easy to return to normal. We don't need to wait, surely, you know, for a crisis situation to kind of reach out. So in a way, if there is something from tonight that I'd like you to kind of remember, is that you playing a part in creating this spiritual community, in creating this connection with other people. Some of the people coming here are looking for meaning. Sometimes they're looking just to be less stressed. They're coming for all sorts of reasons. Some people are coming because they're looking for something that is absent from their life, difficult to articulate. And you may play a part in helping them to articulate that, to express that. So what I want to kind of encourage us to do is to, if you're not doing this already, is to help out. Not just when you're asked, but actually seek out beginner's courses, drop-in classes, see whether you can support them. Supporting them with some of your friends. People coming along to our courses, they see the friendship between the Buddhists, as I did, I remember going on my first retreat and seeing the friendship between the order members. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted some of that. I wanted that kind of connection in my life. Seeing if you can support with your friends. See if you can kind of reach out to people with your friends. Seeing what you can do. That person coming into the centre, although you might feel resistance to going over and talking to them, go over and talk to them. One of the things I would like to do is I would like to help people. I would like to alleviate the problem of loneliness, the very, very human, the ordinary problem of loneliness. I imagine we've all been lonely, haven't we? Is anybody, maybe I should ask you that question. Has anybody here never experienced loneliness? If you put your hand up, never experienced loneliness in your life? Oops. Kind of remembering that. Let me move towards the end of what I want to say. So first, we need to do what we can, I think, to reach out to people, to befriend people. You might even be saving somebody's life. I remember there was a young man I worked with at Windhorse in Cambridge. Well, not a Buddhist. He'd come through the job centre. He'd wanted some casual work and come through the job centre. And he's quite a lonely, isolated young man and very, very hard to reach. Quite well defended in a way, quite hard to reach, but in real need of being reached. But unfortunately, actually, in the end, he took his life. And afterwards, we thought, well, what could we have done? What more could we have done? But it was hard, it's difficult. There's no kind of easy answer to that. He kept people at bay. And I think for the time he was working with us, I like to think that was a time, that was a brighter kind of moment in his life. So the deeper our friendships, the deeper our sangha will be, the more open we will be, the more open we must be to the world. Bhante Sangharakshita has said that Buddhism is spiritual community. When he opened the centre 20 years ago, I was here. I was here for the opening of that. And he said, we have a beautiful centre, but we mustn't stay within it. We must go out. We must reach out to the people in Manchester. We must both reach out to them by going out, and we must reach out to them when they come in to the Buddhist centre. To do that, you need to deepen your spiritual practice. You need to deepen and deepen your connection with the Dharma and with one another. Now, we can talk about Sangha in an abstract way, but Sangha is made up of individual spiritual friendships. Look to your friendships, deepen your friendships. May your friendships thrive, do things together. And I would say, I'm not supposed to say this kind of thing, but I would say that you need to deepen and deepen your Dharma lives. You need to move closer and closer to the order. You need to enter the order. You need to join the spiritual community. You need to decisively commit yourself to the spiritual community. And once in the spiritual community, you need to keep committing yourself, keep deepening your practice. So first of all, we're trying to solve the problem of loneliness and isolation. That is underpinned by something deeper. That is underpinned by our egos, our self-clinging. We need to get to the root delusion that keeps us isolated, keeps us apart from one another, stops us seeing the profound connection between us as human beings. And then we will create real Sangha in Manchester. The more I come to Manchester, the more I see what a challenge you've got here. Here you are in this gritty old kind of Victorian city. Life out there. And it's quite a challenge. It's quite a kind of buzz too. Do what you can. Create a deeper and deeper spiritual community. And if you, there's a Jewish saying. I'm not from a Jewish background, but we've just had a synagogue built next to us, next to our community in Cambridge. And I remember being told this Jewish saying, and it's, if you save one person's life, you save the whole of humanity. And if you take one person's life, you take the whole of humanity. So if you reach out, if you make a difference to one person's life, one person that comes to the centre, you've done a tremendous thing. If we do more of that, and we can do that more of that as a Sangha, as a spiritual community, we can do so much more together than we can do alone. So those are some of my thoughts. I wish you well. I'm part of this altruistic kind of project too. I don't know whether the next time I come to Manchester I will see a difference. I think it's going to be a kind of a growing problem. No simple solutions. But don't forget the world outside the Buddhist Centre. Don't forget to kind of bring them into your meditation. Don't forget to actually do what you can in any way you can to help with the problem of suffering in the world. I'll leave it there. Thank you.